Okay. So, last time, we talked about this pattern that's commonly used in malware that wants to hide itself from signatures and also analysis by anti-malware software authors or researchers. And that's this pattern of having packed or encrypted, and I have scare quotes around encrypted because it's, well, it's not encryption that actually keeps something secret because the machine needs to get at the thing that's encrypted, and using this to hide its code. So then generally we have some sort of decryptor and some encrypted code that this decryptor copies somewhere after transforming it and jumps to. And this doesn't by itself achieve the goal of not having a signature because, well, the decryptor kind of tells you what's going on. And if each piece of malware sort of invents their own decryptor, that's going to be a signature for that piece of malware. So there are a bunch of strategies to kind of try to hide this decryptor based on having its code vary. So one idea was that we'd have a sort of template with some sort of fill-in-the-blanks or maybe a small set of templates and generate sort of a big family of decryptors and do this whenever the malware makes a new copy of itself. And Shore called this oligomorphic, that we have just a little piece of code that generates a decryptor and it can has some fill-in-the-blanks where it can put different things in there, so you can't just write a static pattern. And so hopefully, even if you go through the effort of writing a pattern to match it, it makes it much slower and, you know, less efficient to match. And there's an extension of this idea that rather than having this sort of template where you fill in the blanks, you can have some more generic mutation function, where like you can say, oh, I can insert these useless operations in all these places. I'm just going to have a big library of them. And I'm going to have something where I just take my decryptor code and run it through this filter before writing it out to the newly infected file. So we have this more generic way of generating and changing the decryptor code. But since the assumption is that you protect the decryptor and you're dealing with static matching, you know, things are unchanged after that. And I forgot to write metamorphic on the last time, so we're going to talk about that here. And we mentioned, okay, so we have this, all these sort of packers, and they're doing all this work to hide the decryptor so we can't identify them that way. Is there a way of dealing with them? And there's this sort of this generic algorithm. If we have a decryptor or an packer for some code, we can get at the code by running it in an emulator or a VM and then extracting the code after the decryptor finishes decrypting it. We don't need to actually, you know, figure out what the decryptor does and match its code. We just run it long enough for that to happen. So this motivates sort of the next extension of hiding code, which is called metamorphic. And this is where we apply the transformation techniques to the entire body, you know, entire piece of code, not just a decryptor. So basically we have a generic filter that can take any machine code, well, maybe not any machine code in the universe, but any machine code that would appear in any version of our malware and convert it to a different version of that to defeat this sort of pattern matching. And this needs to be generic enough that it can apply to itself, so we don't have any signature left over. That was kind of the problem that this oligomorphic and polymorphic software runs into with this generic technique, is that, well, you know, the code that generates that decryptor probably, you know, is distinctive once you unpack it. But metamorphic gets rid of that problem and makes it sort of all variable, so you don't have any sort of static pattern you can look for. And the idea that we'd have software analyzing the behavior of the malware in memory in various ways, and including looking at the code this way, suggested that malware would take some other measures to try to defend against this, that rather than just sort of hiding their code, they could work on making it so this technique doesn't work because the malware detects that you're running in an emulator or VM or otherwise behaves differently in that environment or is somehow impractical to run in that environment. You mentioned that there's some simple things, which is generally based on the idea that, well, implementing an emulator or VM is annoying and you're going to miss things. So we can do things like query the machine's devices, that if your virtual machine or emulator doesn't support all the devices that a real machine supports, you can say, gosh, that's suspicious. You know, you don't have a normal looking hard drive. You don't have a normal looking display. That must mean that I'm running in this anti-malware software instead of on the real machine. You can also take advantage of unimplemented features. So for example, if you're writing an emulator, you would probably find it way easier if you could just not implement floating point. Because, you know, most things don't need floating point to run that you care about for anti-malware software. But if malware software notices you're doing that, they're going to care about floating point all of a sudden. They're going to use floating point a lot just because you don't deal with it. And there's other features like that which can be a problem. And we mentioned just the idea of being slow or usually not infecting. That if the goal is that some researcher is or some anti-malware software is going to run some malware in a virtual machine or an emulator and look at what happens, well, you can just take a while to do it and try to outlive their patience. And this is especially true for anti-malware software, where you wouldn't be happy if scanning a file took, you know, many minutes. So there's a question, do malware researchers straight up get a laptop with nothing important on it and run the malware there and wipe it afterwards to get around these techniques? I haven't heard of that being done much, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone used probably not a normal laptop, but some sort of piece of hardware with a debugger attached that was external to the machine. You can set that sort of thing up for like developing embedded software. But I believe the most common thing that malware researchers do is that they just go through the effort of configuring their virtual machines so that these things don't work. And when they discover malware is using those techniques, they just figure out how to break the malware's virtual machine detection. And note that you can do things to break it when you're researching it, like, you know, configure your debugger to automatically jump over that code or something like that. Does that answer that question? Okay. Other questions about things we covered last time? So a brief note about assignments. So in the Lex assignment, I didn't notice that I didn't actually specify. I specified you should say location, and I called this the first byte of the match. Please, it's the place where the first byte is. If for those of you who didn't figure that out, I'm sorry that wasn't clear. That's the intention in that assignment. So when we finished up last time, we were starting to talk about anti-debugging techniques. So we talked here about dealing with virtual machines and emulators, and there's a related issue of debuggers. And there's two pieces of debugging functionality I'm going to talk about. And we started by talking about how breakpoints work. So before we talk about how malware software might try to defeat this, talk about some what, you know, debuggers do to implement breakpoints. And sort of the natural implementation of the breakpoint is that, you know, if you have this machine code in memory, that you'll transform it into some code which contains a jump to the debugger, and the debugger will take control here. And this is a nice natural strategy that's pretty generic. There's some details about actually executing this which are problematic. So one of them is just what the machine code looks like, that the jump might be bigger than the add queue. So in this case, that's not true. So, but there are other instructions we could have here, like, you know, like if this was, say, a push, that would be bigger, that would be smaller than the jump in x86. And if this jump had to be a jump with a 4-byte immediate, this might be bigger than the add queue in x86. So this could be a problem, doesn't need to be, but you know, we need some general solution where it doesn't matter, it shouldn't matter how big this instruction is. And the problem is that if we do the natural thing, it does. That we need to figure out how to fit this jump in a space that's smaller than this instruction, and that won't always be possible. If it's just a normal jump instruction, because jump instructions are typically, you know, not 1 byte, they're typically a couple bytes, and we're kind of hoping that we have a big add instruction with like a rex prefix byte, and so on, so we have enough room, and we don't want to do that. That's not a general strategy. So to make this a general strategy, x86 has a 1-byte instruction that is sort of reserved for debuggers to use as the jump to debugger instruction. And it's int 3, so int is for interrupt, and basically this is a call the OS with code 3. And this is reserved for use of debuggers. And it conveniently encodes to 1 byte. This is the hexadecimal for it. And the debugger will modify the first byte of the instruction where you set the breakpoint to have that. So rather than having this be a jump instruction, it will be int 3 and then some bytes that were left over from the add. That's what the debugger will do this. And when that int 3 instruction runs, it invokes a handler that the operating system sets up, and the debugger, you know, will, you know, do something to arrange with the OS to be run when that handler is called. So questions about this idea of replacing the code with an int 3? So a question is, the debugger would also need to copy the original add instruction somewhere, right? Yes. So part of implementing this is that the debugger is going to have sort of in the debugger's memory, it's going to keep a copy of this instruction so it can restore it later. In particular, if you resume from the breakpoint, it somehow needs to make that work. So one way is it could restore it and jump there. Another way, which is surprisingly common, is the debugger might contain an emulator that can emulate one instruction. So either of those are sort of approaches it could use. Okay. So given that we know that the debugger is actually modifying the machine code, there's something that we can do as part of malware to detect this. And that's that you can just scan your machine code. So for example, you might have code a loop like this. So here, this code loads a counter into RBX and a pointer to the beginning of this code into RAX. And it just reads from the pointer and sums up into that counter every 8 bytes. You know, 8 bytes every 8 bytes. So it just gets a sum with wraparound of all the machine code, and it compares it to an expected value up to some point named encode. And an expected value that's either very carefully arranged, or maybe we put encode like here. It's probably more realistic. And by doing this, if you insert, say, an int 3 here, well, that's going to change what this sum is and make this comparison fail. So this is something that, you know, so malware that doesn't want to be debugged could do, and you could insert code like this at multiple places in the malware to annoy people trying to debug it. And as someone who wants to work around this, you would need to either somehow arrange for your debugger to have a different way of implementing these breakpoints, or arrange for the behavior of reading from your own code to be different than what's run, or you would have to modify this code as you figure out that the malware is doing this. So questions about this idea of checksumming the code?
Can you have a breakpoint before this initial, like, check-in jump to panic?
Can I have a breakpoint
before this check-in jump to panic? So couldn't you have the breakpoint stop and sort of bypass this?
Yeah, so I guess I shouldn't have moved encode. So somehow we have this expected value here. But the idea is that this check can check code that's both before and after itself, right? We can just set my code to point wherever we want. So we can check any region of the malware's code. So as long as you have a potential of missing these sorts of integrity checks, you could potentially trip one no matter where your breakpoint is. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. So I showed, for example, that our breakpoint would be up here, but we could also have this problem with the breakpoint down here. So a question is, what would happen if the virus code inserted its own int3 instruction? So it could do that. That doesn't give it access to system features, but that tries to invoke a debugger for the current process. And typically, if there's no debugger registered for the current process, then you'll get a crash. But this gets to something that I don't have slides for, that's another anti-debugger technique, which is the malware could be built to register a debugger on itself as part of how it operates. Like, it could use that as a way of making a function call. And that would make it annoying to debug, because you need a debugger that can debug debuggers, which is, you know, maybe not a typical feature set. Does that answer that question? Other questions? But most typically, these integrity checks are what we're worried about. And the other sort of thing you can do is, well, there's APIs for just asking, am I being debugged? Because that's often the thing you might want to do in a debugger or something like that. So let's say, so what can debuggers do about this? So one sort of brute force solution is, rather than your debugger using sort of running the code on the real processor, could use an emulator. There's also hardware support for debugging, which allows us to have breakpoints set another way. So for example, on current x86 processors, there are 4 registers for setting breakpoints, which don't involve modifying the machine code. And the processor just implements these in a way where, you know, it doesn't disrupt the machine code. So if you only want to set 4 breakpoints, this is great. And debuggers will take advantage of these registers. The issue is that you might want to set more than 4 breakpoints, in which case, your debuggers are probably going to have to fall back to that int3 technique or something similar. Or do something like single stepping, which we'll talk about next very briefly. So questions about this alternate sort of debugging interface, sort of breakpoint interface. So the question is, could malware fill these registers with garbage values and force the debugger to use N3? So there's a flag associated with this hardware debugging support to say what should happen if someone tries to write it. And this is intended to support nested debugging. So the debugger would be notified, hey, your program you're debugging wants to write the debug registers, and would be told to emulate that. So this is actually properly supported, that if the debugger wanted to use these registers, the debugger could support that properly and not just have it break the debugger and prevent it from using these breakpoint registers. So the question is, I'm talking about debuggers and virtual machines. What's the purpose? And we've been thinking about like two different sort of uses. So one use is if we are working for an anti-malware company and we want to look at what this piece of malware we've discovered on someone's machine does and figure out how to detect it. So that's sort of an analysis use where we use debuggers and virtual machines and emulators. Another use is that our anti-malware software might want to do something automatically where it tries to run something in an emulator of some sort in order to do things like figure out what unpacked code looks like. So there's two different uses, but the techniques that malware uses to combat them are very related. So question, is there a flag or special value to know whether to trigger an exception at a given breakpoint register? So I believe the way these debug registers work is that there's a bunch more of them I haven't mentioned, which control how they operate. You'd have to look up the documentation for this, which I did enough to figure out how many breakpoint registers there were. But not the details of enabling or disabling them. Okay, other questions? Okay. So another debugger feature, which is pretty useful, is what I call single stepping, that the debugger would get control after one instruction runs. And we need to again know how this is implemented. And the implementation on x86 and many other processors are similar. In x86, there's a flag that the debugger can set, which when it's set, when the OS jumps to a program, that program runs for exactly one instruction, and then the OS gets called again. So that's how it's implemented. So there's this processor flag called the trap flag, or TF, that the debugger can arrange to be set. And when it's set, the OS gets to run every instruction for the program. And there's a very simple thing programs can try to do with this, is just that the trap flag is just something that they can read. It's not hidden from the programs. It's not the case like with the debug registers that there's like a way of hiding it from the programs. That's because they weren't thinking of nested debugging. And even if you couldn't like check this flag directly, there are other things that malware could try to do. Like the biggest one is you can check timing. That if someone's doing the single stepping thing, gosh, things are going to be a lot more slow. And you could also like try to say, hey, I'd like to set my own handler and see if that is implemented. Okay. Some questions about our single stepping. Okay. And I guess I should mention, as far as single stepping, is that The single step idea is another alternative a debugger could use to implement breakpoints without modifying the machine code, is that it could just single step and compare the program counter. So that's slower, obviously, but it is a thing that debuggers might do. Okay, so that's sort of about anti-virtualization and anti-debugging techniques. Now, I'm going to have one last thing to talk about with respect to making code hard to decipher. So we talked about this with metamorphic malware, of doing these transformations to add extra stuff to make the code constant. And we talked about obfuscation, where we try to hide control flow and functions. And there's sort of a obfuscation technique, which is kind of an extension of that, which tries to make code hard to analyze. And this is kind of built based around the idea of emulation, is that, if other people can emulate our code, why don't we just make our code an emulator? So the obfuscation technique here is you take your original program and you make up an instruction set for it. And you can actually automate this. And basically, you have a template for what your instruction sets look like. And you change all the opcodes and so on. And you convert the program to that new instruction set. And instead of providing, code that's obfuscated, you provide an interpreter for that instruction set and the code in that instruction set. And the idea is that hopefully this makes all sorts of techniques that people would use to analyze your, machine code that they've developed over time, kind of useless. That's the hope. Whether that's true or not, it's a harder thing. And this is one of the things that Tigris, which I mentioned earlier, was sort of a research tool which had many common obfuscation transformations you might see in more commercial or real malware implements, because it is something that has been seen in malware and commercial software, as it turns out. So to give an example, I'm going to say, go through what you might do to implement this obfuscation technique on this simple function here. And the way Tigris does the transformation is that it generates a new stack-based virtual machine. So what I mean by stack-based, I mean the instructions, rather than using registers, use a little stack. This is the same design that the Java virtual machine does. So basically, they're doing something similar to how the Java virtual machine would work without compilation, just interpreting things. But they're making up their own instruction set rather than using the Java virtual machine instruction set. And they're choosing that based on what operations they need for this piece of code. So I ran Tigris on this and looked at the instructions it generated. And it generated an instruction set which had seven instructions, but some of them had a bunch of different variants. So it had instruction for calling a function. So this, in our example, is used to call printf. But if we had more functions to call, we'd use that. Had a compare instruction. And as I said, this was a stack-based virtual machine, so the way that worked is that it popped two values from a stack, which was in the interpreter, just a data structure, and then pushed the compared value. It had instructions to push constants or values from a table. It had instructions to set a local variable that would be used as arguments for a function. And it had an if instruction, if go to instruction, and a return instruction to exit the function. So, you can imagine that there would be extra ones of these if there were operations besides comparing, calling a function, and returning, and if. But basically, the way Tigris works, it just has a bunch of templates for what sort of instructions we would need, and it does like what a compiler would do, but rather than compiling to, a assembly, it compiles to this sort of custom instruction set. And then it produces, you know, this as a program. So the program ends up being, we have, again, our little stack here. So we're going to push 10. We're going to push the argument X. We're going to then run this compare instruction. So get this X less than 10. Then we're going to do our if. And possibly jump to the end. And if that doesn't happen, we're going to push yes. And then push. And then set yes as a local variable. And then call printf. So there's a question, why does this use a little stack instead of registers? And the reason for that is just to make the implementation easy. So Tigris just generates a C function. And, you know, so this is the sort of code it generates. So it puts this code in an array of bytes. So in our program, there's going to be, in the obfuscated, like, C version of this, it's going to be, like, an array of bytes that contains this. And in the resulting executable file, it's just going to be global with an initial value that's a bunch of weird bytes. And then there was some code which keeps track of a program counter and a stack pointer and has a switch statement here which looks at the opcode, you know, check the current opcode. And each of the cases here is going to use the PC variable emulated program counter is going to look at the PC variable if it needs to retrieve operand, PC to get operands. So our typical code is going to be like PC plus equals instruction length in each of these cases. And it's going to use this SP variable to push and pop things. And so the reason why we're using a little stack is that we're going to, you know, have a convenient way of implementing push and pop that's going to be easier, is the thought, than doing, like, implementing a little set of registers. So that would have been another possibility for them. So the question, so why is this useful? Why doesn't this just end up as machine code that we can get a good assembly for? And the answer is, of course, yes. You know, we can look at the machine code this generates and figure out what it does. The hope is that a lot of the things we were trying to do to identify code were based on, oh, once we get the machine code and figure out what operations it does, we've kind of figured out what the malware does. Whereas here, most of the information about what the, you know, so the actual operations, you know, here is in this array here, which is our opcodes, and that's kind of data. Where, so techniques we were using that would kind of extract the machine code, you know, are going to give us, you know, there's an interpreter here, but they aren't going to tell us what the malware does. We're going to have to go through this extra step of figuring out this is the data that's important and decoding that. And that's the thought about behind it of why people have tried to do this as sort of their obfuscation technique. Does that answer that question? Okay. So, as I said, this is a technique people really use. I think it's reasonable, however, to be dubious about whether it actually is useful as they think it is. It has a huge performance impact. And, well, you know, while we're going to have data be responsible for all the logic, we can do all the sorts of things that we did with machine code on the new instruction set. We just need to figure out how to adapt all the things we were doing on normal machine code to the sort of new instruction set. And also, know, even if we ignore the new instruction set, if we have a trace of everything that's done, that's still helpful because, you know, we still get what the behavior was in practice and what, like, arithmetic is done. That's still going to be in there. We can still get that without figuring out anything about the machine code. Sorry about the new instruction set machine code, I should say. So questions on this sort of make an emulator technique? So, one more thing on sort of trying to evade antivirus software that's worth talking about is probably the most direct way of doing it, which is, you know, just modify the antivirus software. So, this is a thing some malware has done. It said, like, oh, I know this antivirus software has a signature database. Let's just fix that signature database so it doesn't have my signature anymore. And maybe the anti-malware software, you know, tries to make sure the signature files don't change by using a checksum. Well, you know, if they aren't good about doing that, if they don't pay attention to cryptographic results, so they use a non-cryptographic checksum, you could preserve that. You can also do things like register your own handlers to filter things that either the antivirus software would do or that sysadmins would do. And we mentioned the idea of, like, registering handlers to observe system behavior when we talked about how antivirus software would work, you know. So this is sort of the same way, you know, antivirus software checks malware behavior. We can apply that same technique to check antivirus software behavior and hide from it. So one example is that, you know, maybe we want to make it so antivirus software doesn't find our executable. You know, so if it's a worm, you know, has, or something like that, or maybe we have to make it so, in this example, antivirus software, when it reads the executable, it reads the normal thing. So here, what we do is we'd say, let's override the open file function in the OS, you know, using the same kind of techniques antivirus software would use to make sure it got called and could, like, scan files or check for programs modifying files. Using that same sort of technique, let's filter file openings. And if they're trying to open an executable we infected, we'll just have them read a different file. And otherwise, it will behave the same. So this sort of idea, you know, allows sort of malware that's, you know, already on the system to be stealthy to things that would try to detect it. And this open file is just one of the many things you would imagine this sort of malware would overwrite. You'd overwrite, like, the call to get file modification times and say, yep, they haven't changed. Or to get files in a directory. This directory does not contain any of the virus files, even if there are some. Or you'd overwrite the read file operation, but not like we've shown there, but not the execute file operation. Or you'd overwrite the sort of get the running programs. Oh, the malware program might be running, and you just overwrite the call to get the list of running programs to not include it. So these are common things that malware would do, and often this idea of doing this is called a rootkit, that you're getting sort of privilege on a machine and then hiding yourself with these sorts of techniques by overriding the various ways of, you know, scanning for the malicious software. So you might say, so what do we do about this? So one thing is you make sure that you have checks for what's happening in place before the malware gets a chance to install these changes. And often there are sort of heuristic things that people do to try to detect these, though it's not reliable because if you overwrite all the right handlers, you can kind of hide pretty perfectly from inspection on the running system. You'd have to like do something like inspect the system files from another system that you know doesn't have any of these special handlers installed. So an example of sort of the heuristic technique to try to figure out if that sort of thing is installed is basically what you look for is, well, if someone overwrote these things, they probably missed some little bits. So for example, there's a Unix program that's well known called check rootkit, which tries to find rootkit signs. And basically, the way it works is it has a bunch of signatures for rootkits which have been observed. So it searches for those. And it, one way is it like searches in a much signature-like way, where it says, well, if these rootkits are installed, some system programs probably have a different version, and it just searches for strings they know that rootkits include in their different versions of the system programs. Because common technique on Unix-like systems is like to make the ls command be a new ls command that doesn't list certain files, for example. So they'll just scan for strings that appear in that new ls command in rootkits they've seen before. So obviously that could be evaded by using those oligomorphic and so on techniques we talked about. It also does some consistency checks. So it like gets a process list and compares it to other ways of getting the process list, because often these rootkits will forget to override all the different ways of listing processes or scanning for processes. And similarly with getting file lists and other ways you can count files. So look for consistency, look for signs that things were overwritten, and also just, again, as a sort of signature thing, scan for suspiciously named files that they've seen in existing rootkits. So question is, by strings, do I mean actual string data or just code snippets? I mean actual string data. The reason why you look more for string data than code snippets, I would guess, I'm not fully sure, but I think a lot of these rootkits are compiled on the system they're installed on. That the typical way that that they're used is that someone downloads C code to the system and compiles it, is often how they're installed. So looking for specific code snippets would be less productive because you'd have different compilers. Other questions? And I guess probably worth mentioning, why would there be telltale strings? So for example, if the ls program that they install contains like, you know, if file equals my worm, well, you just search for the string my worm in there as part of the implementation of that. Yes.
I had a quick question just about the stealth again, just like the slide stealth on it.
Yeah.
So like, what was the whole, I mean, I understand the purpose of it, but I'm just confused as to, because I know this is, it's a string copy, right? That second line is string.
So this is not string copy. This is string compare.
String compare.
Good question.
So the whole purpose of this, right, is so that it can compare the file name, the infected executable essentially, and if it's equal to each other, then you run like, can you explain that again? I'm sorry.
So the purpose of this is that the goal is that this replaces the normal open file call. So when, for example, our antivirus software tries to open a file, rather than making the normal call to open file, it calls this function. And so let's say our antivirus software is trying to scan infected.exe. Well, we're gonna let it scan clean.exe.
Oh, so this is for antivirus software would have this function embedded into its program, right?
So the virus would embed this into somehow into the antivirus software. Most commonly, the way this would work is by like overwriting the system libraries. Okay. So like this might be in the C standard library that the virus modified.
So the whole point of it is so that you don't run that infected file, or it doesn't see that the antivirus does not see the infected file.
Yes. So yeah, the question is there. The point of this is that yeah, so anyone trying to read the infected executable normally won't get to see it.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
So good question. I know that this stuff confuses people sometimes. So this is sort of yeah. So this is in virus, you know, but set up. So anyone opening files calls this code. So this is sort of installed globally on the system. Other questions about this stealth idea? So, our next topic and our next sort of string of topics, we're going to talk about not malware and anti-malware software, unless we have sort of some special topics maybe to talk about for that. We're going to talk about vulnerabilities and exploits. And we're going to primarily be looking at sort of memory safety things. And we're going to start with sort of the most classic of memory safety bugs, which are going to be buffer overflows. We also may talk about some other types of vulnerabilities later on. And I believe these are slides I used earlier, but as a reminder, so a vulnerability is something that can be exploited to do something. The exploit is something that actually does something with a vulnerability, a bug that some attacker can use to cause behavior the attacker wants that is not supposed to be allowed. And we're going to look at buffer overflows. So I believe in 3710, which most of you have taken, they go over basic buffer overflows. So we're going to talk about a particular kind of buffer overflows known as stack smashing, which is going to be our first illustration of sort of buffer overflows as not just a thing where you get lucky, but as a something where if you have this type of bug, it ends up being the case that you have a problem. So the general idea of buffer overflows, we have a buffer, like as in like an array, something like that. And, you know, this is our buffer. And the attacker can cause us to write to the buffer, to go beyond the end of it. And there's some, for some reason, there is something important here. So this is sort of the classic buffer overflow pattern. And it's what we're going to look at first, is this idea that we're writing the whole buffer and we can specify too much data. And somehow there's something important afterwards. And we're going to take advantage of that. We're going to look at this first. And buffer overflows are part of sort of a family of bugs that are, I would call, memory management bugs. So in the case of a buffer overflow, the memory management problem is that we have a buffer and we didn't enforce that we stay within it. But there's a bunch of them out there. And we're going to look at buffer overflows because, well, they used to be the most common type of vulnerability by a very wide margin. And it used to be the case that buffer overflows almost always resulted in arbitrary code execution. By that, I mean there was an exploit where the attacker could choose any code they wanted to run and run it as a result of this buffer overflow. So fortunately, things are better. We'll talk about the things that have been done to make it better and how this can and can't be still exploitable over the next several weeks. And the classic case where people are most worried about buffer overflows are things that deal with servers. So if you have a server on the web, you're accepting input from just about anyone, and it's really bad if that input goes into a buffer and you go over the end of the buffer and that causes you to run code that they chose and you didn't. And this has been a problem since forever. And going back to the Morris worm, which the Morris worm was the first piece of self-replicating malware that spread on the, spread on the net. And it used a buffer overflow in certain mail servers and servers to give you info about users on a multi-user system. Famously in 2001, there was a worm called Code Red that spread between web servers, again, using one of these buffer overflows, where it could just open a connection to a server and send something that would fill up a buffer and overwrite it, causing some code. The other big reason why, we might be really concerned about buffer overflow vulnerabilities is that they often occur when bugs that deal with corrupt files. So for example, if we're thinking about Flash or PDFs, I guess maybe not Flash anymore, but PDFs or like image viewers and so on, these often have to put things into buffers. And if there's a bug in how they deal with the length information being wrong, this could mean that I download a PDF and suddenly code is running on my system that's chosen by whoever made that PDF document, rather than code that's part of the PDF reader. So to think about buffer overflows, I'm going to start with what I think is review, sort of a simple overflow of the sort that I believe typically 3710 goes over. I'm not sure. I gather that 3710 teaches this not completely consistently, and we probably need to review anyway before we go on to our main topic, which is going to be stack smashing, which this is not. This is a simple overflow. So here I have a variable score and a variable buffer, and I call this function getS. So getS is a function which, takes a buffer and writes a lot, and it reads from standard in, reads a line of input into the buffer. And getS is a function you should never use, and you so much should never use it that in the current version of Linux, it no longer is enabled by default. You have to turn it on. And you will get a warning if you try to link programs that use it. But it used to be the case that people said, gosh, that's a really nice function, and used it all the time. And it's vulnerable to buffer overflows because this function, it just reads a line of input into the memory for this buffer. It doesn't care how big the buffer is. It doesn't even know how big the buffer is. It just actually, if we look at its prototype, it just gets a pointer to the buffer. It doesn't get its size. So it can't know. And if we imagine this function is compiled in the most straightforward way, we would say, okay, well, we have two local variables here. Where do we put local variables? Well, the most straightforward way maybe is put them on the stack. We could put them in registers if we're being clever. Well, let's say we do the simplest possible thing and put them on the stack. So in that case, let's say, this is what our stack looks like. We have our buffer. We have our score, and when getS is running, getS gets a pointer to this buffer, which is the argument to getS, points to getS, which is in RDI, points to this buffer here. And just after the buffer is where we store the score on the stack, and let's say then we have the return address for this function, which will come up later. So let's say, getS, gets its input here, and let's say it's 103 A's. Well, what's going to happen then is GetS is going to write the first 100 A's to the buffer, and then it's not going to stop. It's going to keep going, and it's going to write 3 more A's to the score. And while the score is an integer, it's not a string, so that's going to be interpreted differently. So our score will end up being having the ASCII for A 4 times, and this ends up being the value 616161. So probably a much higher score than we're supposed to get, and not sort of following what this code was intending to do of just setting the score between 0 and num questions. So questions about how this simple buffer overflow would work. So this kind of buffer overflow, it seems like a problem, but it seems like a very contrived problem, that I needed the compiler to lay out the stack just right, to put the thing that I was trying to change on the stack in, you know, in the right area. And I need to know exactly what this code looked like. It seemed like a lot of things had to go right for this exploit, or wrong, depending on your perspective, for this problem, this exploit to work. So we're going to learn about stack smashing, where we're going to say, well, we don't need to get so lucky, that there's something that compilers are doing all the time, which is going to be just as good and even more powerful than what we're seeing here of changing this important variable. But to think about that, we're going to have to think about the same sorts of things about where does data go when we go outside the buffer? Where are other things located relative to the buffer? And if the buffer's on the stack, which is what we're going to look at for, you know, our first foray into these buffer overflows, we want to think about what else is on the stack. So let's do a little exercise for that. So here I have a similar function. I have a buffer and an array of scores, and I fill in the array of scores by calling great answer after doing get s into the buffer. And my question is, how many bytes after the beginning of the buffer is the beginning of this scores array? And so let's do that. And hopefully it's actually after, because I didn't give an option for before. And the thing I would look out for is get s, what are the arguments? And great answer, what are the arguments? That's the, I think, the easiest way to figure out where these two things are. I probably should have included a... So let's give it some time. So So the way you can go about this systematically is you can configure everything on the stack. So you know when the function starts, the return address is at the top of the stack. So this is increasing addresses. Then we push RBP and RBX. So those are old values are stored next. Then we subtract 72 bytes from the stack pointer. And then we have these calculations. So RBP points to plus 8. And then we have this here, points to plus 24. I'll give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so I believe the best answer is 16, which wasn't one of the options because I made a mistake. But it's 16 bytes. I did fence post error and didn't include that in the option, but it should be 16 bytes. And the reason why is that RBP is 8 bytes after the stack pointer, and that's what is passed to get us. So buffer here is this stack pointer plus 8, and RDI is going to be the base of the array scores I, because this line of assembly here corresponds to the assignment here, and I is RBX. So RDI here is the base of the array scores, which is 24 plus the stack pointer. We subtract those two, we get 16. So it turns out that the layout is that we have 8 unused bytes. So we have 8 unused bytes, followed by a 16-byte buffer, followed by a 40-byte scores array, followed by the safe value of RBX, the safe value of RBP, and the safe value of, and the return address for this function. So questions about this? So the question isn't the base of the array. So the base of the array is 24 bytes and the base buffer 8 bytes. That is correct. So the difference is 24 minus 8. Which is 16.
Could you say that again? That last.
So the base of the buffer is 8 bytes from the stack pointer. The base of the array is 24 bytes from the stack pointer. So the distance between the two is 16 bytes.
How are you getting 24 and 8?
So I know the argument to get us is this RBP value, because it goes into RDI just before the call. And that's 8 plus RSP from this LEA instruction. The value we use to access the scores array, the base address, is 24 plus RSP, which is used by this move instruction, which is where what's moving the return value of grade answer, which is an EAX, into memory.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? So couldn't we say a care buffer of 16 elements is size 16, so it would be 16 bytes based on that? And the answer is going to be no. So for example, if I were to change this care buffer to be, instead of 16, I had this be 15, I would probably get the same assembly. Even though it seems like there's a wasted byte, and the reason why is that the compiler likes keeping things like the int array at a multiple of 4 on the stack. And things like that are going to mean that you have to look a little more carefully than the size of the buffer in the C code. Does that answer that question? So the question is, couldn't you just look for multiple then? So the other thing that we might be worried about the compiler doing is that the compiler could have laid out the stack in the opposite direction. Rather than doing buffer scores, it could have done scores then buffer. So we did want to actually check to see what was going on. In addition, another thing we might be worried about is what if the compiler is saving other stuff to the stack, like these registers that it saves temporarily, what if it saves those between the buffer, between the arrays? That's another thing the compiler might choose to do. That answer those questions? Okay. And probably the more bigger reason why I'm doing this exercise is that we're going to be concerned about finding this relative to the buffer. And to do that, we really need to know what's going on with that. So, second question, given now that we know sort of layout, what happens if I write a bunch of ones into the buffer? And for simplicity, let's assume I do this when I equals, you know, I is greater than 0. So not the first iteration of this loop. Okay, so I think we have answers from most. So the plurality answer is correct. So the thing to remember is that getS thinks the whole thing is a string. So it's writing ASCII characters because that's how you get input from the keyboard. And it's the same scenario we saw here, that in this case it's not A's, but it's 1, but getS thinks it's a string. It doesn't realize the string doesn't end before the scores array, so it's still writing bytes like it would write in a string. Those bytes are going to be ASCII characters. It's going to write enough of them to cover all of score zero, because we know that score zero appears after 16 characters, 16 bytes, and it's 4 bytes long, so it's going to be 16 bytes 16 through 20 of the input, and those are going to be all the character one repeated, and get us just reading it as a string. So our answer is going to be the 0x313131 value is what's going to be in there, because 0x31 is the one character. So questions about how I got that answer?
Since we are more than like, since this goes over the scores array, something else will be affected as well, right?
Or so the question is, will things beyond score zero be affected? Absolutely. And we'll talk about some of those issues next. So I just went over sort of mechanics of this sort of trivial overflow where we have a target that's right next to it. And as I said, it seems like a special situation. But there's a pattern that exists with buffer overflows on the stack, which allows us to have an exploit that works previously most of the time. So there was something which for a long time before compilers and operating systems and linkers did some things to mitigate this that would work for essentially all buffers on the stack. Like any buffer on the stack that had an overflow, you could use this one technique. You didn't need to get lucky. Just needed to be a buffer on the stack that you could write over the end of, and you could, you know, run whatever code you liked. And this technique is known as stack smashing. Most famously, it was described in this article by Alf One in what is sometimes politely referred to as the non-traditional literature, meaning not stuff published by academics, but sort of an undergroundish publication of the Frack magazine, which was originally distributed as sort of text files, which is why it looks like this with ASCII art. So written by Alf One, which was whose legal name is Elias Levy. In 1996, so published this sort of how-to guide. The technique's much older than that, but this sort of documented and popularized it, made it well-known. And as I said, this is a generic technique. And I'm going to start with this example of a vulnerable function. So I just read into a buffer. Here I'm using scanf that just reads a string from standard in into the buffer. And this function's vulnerable, even though there is, you know, no other interesting variables in this function. So there's in the function. Unlike our previous case. Don't need them. And to think about why this is going to be a problem, let's see what happens if I input a 100 character string. So I have this program. I put a 100 character string, it set faults. Okay, that's not surprising, but that just crashes. That's bad, but it's not something where I'm going to be like super worried that an attacker is going to make my system do bad things. It's not subtle. But if I run it in a debugger, I see something very disturbing. That if I run this in my debugger, I get in my backtrace, I see this regular pattern. And that's a bad sign, because that seems to indicate that we can control, you know, what ends up, you know, running in some way, because this address somehow was changed, this address that we're supposed to return to. And we'll talk about sort of how we can systematically exploit that next time. So this is where I'll leave off for today. And next week we'll look into, you know, applying this knowledge that, wait a moment, we changed a return address and how we can take advantage of that.
Yeah, sorry, can you explain the checksum one more time? I didn't get that part entirely.
Okay, so you're asking when I talked about for anti-debugging checksums?
Yeah.
So the idea is that our debugger, if we insert a breakpoint, is going to change code like here or here. Mm-hmm. So what we can do is we can read all the code and like compute the sum with wraparound. So just an arbitrary value that's computed using all of the machine code, and compare it to a value we expect. And if it disagrees, we know someone changed the code, such as a debugger inserting a breakpoint.
Oh, so adding all the byte values of the entire virus code?
Yeah. Yeah. And okay, we could use any calculation that depends on the entire virus code.
Okay.
Or an important part of the virus code.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions?
And just to like expand on that kind of concept, this is for a virus trying to make an antivirus not be able to, like, not to work, right, essentially?
Or? So this is for someone writing any sort of malware who wants to make someone debugging it have a bad time.
Okay. So basically, this will prevent it from the debugger actually running because it doesn't match the checksum value, essentially, right?
Yeah, so typically when people try to do this, they try to be more subtle than that. So basically, you know, you'll be able to run it in the debugger and then it will break in some way. Like this code here will do something that will break things.
Okay. Also, if it's possible, I don't know if anybody else has questions, but could you go back to the question we had in terms of the stack, exercise stack layout? That first question you had.
Yeah,
there we go. Why is the value of, why are we subtracting 72 from RSP, for example?
So the question is, the compiler is doing that to allocate space for scores and the buffer. And it allocates an additional 8 bytes. And we didn't actually talk about why. It's a good question. And the reason why is there's a rule in the calling convention that the stack address needs to be a multiple of 16 before the compiler is allowed, actually 8 off from a multiple of 16 before it's allowed to call a function.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?